Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the U.S. presidential transition. Last week, U.S. voters elected Joe Biden president, triggering a change in administrations. For the next 10 weeks until Inauguration Day, I will be sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming administration. With me this week to kick off this special series and to provide us an overview of what Biden can expect to find in his inbox when he takes his seat in the Oval Office is Richard Haass. Richard is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, which for the purposes of full disclosure means he's my boss. Richard has extensive government experience, having served in 4 presidential administrations. He has written extensively on international affairs and foreign policy. His latest book, which I highly recommend, is The World, A Brief Introduction. Richard, thanks for joining me today.
Good as always to be with you, sir.
I want to talk about the foreign policy inbox facing a President Biden. But before we get there, Richard, I want to talk a little bit about the transition because Inauguration Day is 10 weeks away. The United States is an outlier among advanced industrialized democracies in taking so long to hand over power. The British do it overnight. The French, who have a presidential system somewhat similar to ours, take just 10 days. So as you look at this long transition, almost 2.5 months, what dangers lurk there?
Well, you've got normal transitions, Jim, and then you've got this one. Under a normal transition, it's a 10-week period of a certain uncertainty around the world, in the country. You only have one president at a time, but there's a sense that power informally passes to the president-elect. So it creates some ambiguity. And if there were to be a crisis that were initiated somewhere around the world, it puts both the incumbent and the president-elect in awkward positions. But that's not the challenges this time, per se. It seems to me what makes this transition more fraught for many reasons. One is the context in terms of COVID-19. We've got Americans dying at the rate of well over 1,000 a day. By inauguration, it's conceivable we could have 1,500 or 2,000 people a day. Dying hospitals could be at or past their limits. So we've got that plus all the economic problems. Still, we've got the president not accepting the results of the election. We have him not cooperating with the transition process, essentially not accepting the need for a transition because he has not accepted that he has lost. So you have essentially the Democrats preparing a transition, but almost, how would I put it, on their own. You have the standing up, for example, of a COVID task force, but it's apparently being done without cooperation with the administration's COVID task force. I guess the only other thing I'd add is we don't know what the president is going to do or not do vis-a-vis COVID-19. He's already now fired the Secretary of Defense. We don't know what other personnel changes there could be. We don't know what executive actions might be taken. This is an administration that hasn't bought into the word norm from the beginning. So normally during a transition, the soon-to-be former administration usually acts with considerable restraint. And I wouldn't necessarily count on it. So it's quite possible you'll have everything from a truly messy handover, a non-cooperative transition, to all sorts of actions taken by an outgoing administration that an incoming administration might decide it has to undo.
Do you worry that another country, another great power, might try to take advantage of what looks to be a confusing and contentious handover of power? Or are there dynamics out there that would discourage countries from trying to take advantage of this interregnum?
Look, the answer is both. I worry that they may think that we're unfocused, that we're disorganized, and there are grounds for understanding why they might think that. On the other hand, I think they are somewhat restrained, almost deterred, because even if they were to take action now that was, say, hostile or aggressive, talk about getting off on the wrong foot with the new American administration. To present them with that kind of a fait accompli when they took office seems to me a very dangerous way to go. Also, this president, the 45th president, has been unpredictable from the get-go. And one of the dangers, I would think, if you're a foreign actor, is you have no idea. For all you know, he'd come down on you like a ton of bricks because he'd want to make some sort of a parting statement. My guess is, for the most part, it's always dangerous to make predictions, particularly about the future. But my betting is a little bit more in the direction that other, certainly major governments, would act with restraint. Whether some less than major governments or some non-governmental groups, a terrorist group might try to act to advantage their position, or a group like the Taliban or Hezbollah. I don't rule that out.
So let's talk about what the foreign policy inbox is likely to look like for a President Biden come January 20th. You've already noted that COVID-19 hovers over everything. What are the other big foreign policy challenges a President Biden is going to inherit?
Well, let's just begin with the basic point. President-elect Biden, between now and then, and even after then, he can make a lot of choices. He's already made the choice of Kamala Harris as his vice president. He will make the choice about who will constitute his cabinet. He will decide what he says on Inauguration Day and so forth and so on. The only thing he can't choose is what you just asked me about, his inbox. Inboxes get presented to a president domestically and internationally. You've got COVID domestically. Again, you could well have an outgoing president who hasn't conceded. You could have tens of millions of Americans who would think the election was somehow illegitimate, raising questions about the political legitimacy of Mr. Biden. You obviously have deep divisions in the country politically over race, over wealth. A lot of that has been exacerbated over the last few months. So I think the first thing to be said is that domestically, this is a rough inheritance. Internationally, what you have is not a crisis, but you have two sets of structural challenges. One is the revival of great power rivalry, and it's been a gradual phenomenon, whether it's with Russia, with China, various manifestations. But the hopes that greeted the end of the Cold War 30 years ago clearly have not been borne out. And then you've got a whole set of global challenges, obviously health and infectious disease being the most obvious, but climate change, proliferation, terrorism, monetary questions given the skyrocketing of debt, global trading order that, shall we say, has got a lot of sand in the gears. You've got a cyberspace, a digital domain that essentially is unregulated. So the new president is also going to inherit all of that and some of the particular manifestations, things like North Korea, Iran, Venezuela. You've got wars in the Middle East, in Yemen, Syria, Libya. What, 1% of the world is either a refugee or internally displaced? You know, one could go on, but what it is, again, is an awfully tough international environment at a time where American alliances are in rough shape, in large part because of the last few years, and at a time when the United States has opted over the last few years to withdraw from any number of international institutions and arrangements. So that's essentially the international inheritance.
So it sounds like a world in disarray, if I may borrow the title of one of your books, Richard. But I actually want to, you know, before we sort of drill down in some of these foreign policy challenges, you mentioned the fact that a President Biden will come into office facing a very large set of domestic issues. Clearly, this was a campaign run largely on domestic issues. Foreign policy didn't feature that prominently. Do you expect a Biden presidency to similarly focus like a laser beam on domestic issues? Will it have time to pay attention to or make foreign policy an issue or a priority?
I've been thinking about that. I think the preponderance of the focus will have to be internal. And that's also where there's an area of your expertise. It's harder for a president often to do things without Congress being involved. And we don't yet know the composition of the Senate. Won't know that until the end of the first week, probably of January. But I do think there are things that can be done in foreign policy, even if the preponderance of the focus is internal, simply because they don't take a lot of heavy lifting. If the president wants to announce that the United States is re-entering the World Health Organization or the Paris Climate Accords, he can pretty much do it. If he wants to have some consultations and have his new Secretary of State meet with European allies or Asian allies, that can easily be accomplished. If he wants to announce that the United States will participate in global efforts to produce and distribute a vaccine as they become available, he can do that. There's some low-hanging fruit out there that doesn't require, in the first instance, congressional involvement. And I think that's the area, particularly using the diplomatic instrument of American foreign policy as opposed to the military instrument or economic instruments. It seems to me the easiest thing to do is to act diplomatically, and that could mean doing some things or undoing some things. And my hunch is early on, you'll see a combination of the two from President Biden.
Well, I have to ask you that it's clearly no secret that Joe Biden offers a very different vision of American foreign policy, of America's role in the world. In some sense, it has a bit of a restorationist flavor, trying to return to an approach to foreign policy that characterized American presidents before Donald Trump came into office. But I'm curious, you know, from your point of view, obviously, nobody can hit the rewind tape and go back. Mm-hmm. On sort of a meta level, how likely do you think other countries are going to respond to American foreign policy that does want to try to have the United States more engaged to sort of flex America's leadership muscles? Is that going to go over well, or are we going to find that the world has moved on?
By and large, it'll go over well. It'll certainly go over well with our principal partners in Europe and Asia. If one looks at some of the street celebrations, one looks at the rapidity of the congratulation message, the tone of them from Europe and Asia.
I'll note that Chancellor Merkel was very prompt in congratulating yes. Vice President Biden on becoming president-elect.
Yes, and let me just say some other governments are not quite so prompt. The authoritarian governments are clearly less prompt. Clearly, I think for them, this is not good in many ways. Once again, the United States is more likely to be an example of a fully functioning democracy. Once again, issues of human rights and democracy promotion are likely to come to the fore. Once again, cooperation with allies is likely to be a staple of American foreign policy for all these reasons. If you're Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping, maybe Mr. Erdogan in Turkey, president of the Philippines, this is not necessarily a good set of developments for you. I think for countries like Israel or Saudi Arabia, they had, what's the diplomatic phrase, special relationships with this administration. And they are obviously concerned that they will have much less access and they're more likely to be on the receiving end of some U.S. criticism over the next 4 years than they were over the last 4 years. And I think for countries like Israel and Saudi Arabia, they're going to very quickly have to figure out how do they navigate things with this president. But by and large, I think the democracies are happy and the authoritarian / populist leaders around the world are probably much less comfortable.
I'm curious, Richard, as I mentioned at the top, you're a veteran of four presidential administrations. You're also someone who spent a fair amount of time in Washington. You know the old saying, personnel is policy. Now, I don't want to get into who President-elect Biden may pick or not pick, but how important are the choices that he makes for Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and other positions we can think of for his ability to conduct foreign policy effectively? Maybe another way to say it, how much does the president himself really dominate and matter, and how much of it really does depend upon the team he assembles?
Look, the answer is both. As you said before, though, this president is going to have to probably devote the lion's share of his time internally. So I think the team becomes important. I think the good news for Joe Biden, he's got a lot of experienced people to choose from. And I don't know who he's going to choose, but a lot of them, am I allowed to use football analogies on your show?
You are allowed to use football analogies. We just have to note that it's American football you're talking about, not the kind of football they play in the rest of the world.
But you've got a lot of people who I would say essentially are playing the game not that far from midfield. They've worked in previous administrations, whether it's the Obama administration, in some cases, Clinton administration or both. You could conceivably have some people who worked in a Bush administration. So my sense is he's got a deep bench of experienced centrist hands to choose from, many of whom have dealt with Russia or China or North Korea or Iran or any of the other challenges. And obviously, there's going to be a big push on climate, a big push on global health. You're going to have a lot of people who have thought hard about China. So my guess is the president's going to have to delegate an awful lot of the day-to-day, but that's as it should be. You don't want your president being the chief operations person. There are certain things only a president can do, but there's many things, while a president could do them, you really don't want the president to be doing them.
I was writing down all of the issues you noted that Joe Biden will have in his inbox when he sits down behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. You mentioned China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, trade, health, the list goes on. And I'm sort of curious, as you think about it, what should his priorities be? Now, there's the old saying that if everything's a priority, nothing is. And again, right. When you have just a laundry list of things to do and presidential time is scarce, where should President Biden be focusing his attention?
It's the right question. I found a useful concept in thinking this through, Jim. I published a piece on it in Foreign Affairs, and it comes from a Jewish concept. It's called tikkun olam, to fix the world or repair the world. In Judaism, it applies to individuals. It's our responsibility to live our lives, not simply concerned with our personal well-being or welfare, but rather our communities, our societies. And I think in this case, repair the world, tikkun olam, the president's going to walk into a really demanding situation domestically and internationally. And my instincts are that for the first 6 to 9 to 12 months, essentially for his first year, certainly through the fall, he has got to deal with repair work. Rather than think of it as a major innovation phase, he's got to deal with COVID, domestic challenges of it, getting the U.S. back in the WHO, dealing with the vaccine issue internationally, get alliances up and running again, rebuild consultations. Because again, alliances are your force multipliers for everything else you might want to do regionally and globally. So you've got to get them back up in working order. You've got to get back in certain organizations and arrangements. You've got to get your people in place. You've got to reestablish a national security process. Then you've got to go through the initial set of policy reviews. This is a good 6 to 9 month process. And I don't know how long it's going to take to get people confirmed.
Richard, can I just stop you there? Because I think for a lot of people who have never been in government, don't understand the complexity of the so-called interagency process and the importance it has to being able to have an effective functional foreign policy. Could you just give us sort of just a brief overview of how to make that work? Because my sense is the Trump administration saw the interagency process fall apart.
They did see it fall apart. It's not the first administration to do that. And they set up competing processes, often very narrow, informal decision-making loops in order to avoid an interagency process. The whole idea of a process, though, is to bring in, it's going to sound a little bit wonky, I apologize, but the various agencies and departments that should be at the table, the so-called stakeholders. So if you're dealing with what you and I are talking about, national security, foreign policy, it's the State Department, it's the Defense Department, both the civilian side and the military, it's the intelligence agencies, who obviously it could be the Treasury, or could be energy, depending upon the issue at hand. And then you've got at the center, you've got the National Security Council, the National Security Advisor, who kind of play traffic cop, teeing up the issues, making sure the right people are involved, and so forth, ultimately driving things towards decisions. And once decisions are made by the president, then overseeing the implementation. To get this up to speed is easier said than done. Again, you've got to get hundreds and hundreds, nearly thousands of people in place. The average president, my numbers may be slightly out of date, Jim, but there's something like 4,000 plus or minus political appointees around the administration. That's a lot of people to get appointed, many of whom have to be vetted and confirmed and so forth. So there's that.
And many of whom never work with each other.
Two parts. One is, no matter how current you think you are with the issues, when you go into government, it's a layer of detail. It's just different being an outsider and an insider. And then, as you say, there's a sociological dimension. Until people have worked together within their own buildings and with people from around the government, it hasn't sorted itself out. Often it takes a crisis. Very rarely is the first real test of an administration a clear success. Almost always, it's just the opposite, because the parts haven't figured out really how to mesh, and people haven't built up confidence with one another, haven't learned what strengths and weaknesses are. My experience, this all takes the best part of 6 to 9 months if you're lucky. And that's why I think, again, the first 6 to 9 months, I would say to a Biden administration, don't bite off more than you have to chew. Again, repair before you build. So I think, again, the first 6 months ought to be to set up what we were just talking about, almost to exercise it with these initial policy reviews, deal with COVID, revive your alliances, re-enter a few administrations. That's a lot. But this is not a time you've got to figure out every dimension of a comprehensive China policy or a Russia policy or a Middle East policy or a North Korea policy or a climate change policy. You've got time to do some of that. You know, Jim Baker, one of the great secretaries of state who I work with a lot, used to say, you know, you got to crawl before you walk and you got to walk before you run. And what I'm basically saying here, but I don't do it in a terrible Southern or Western accent, being born in Brooklyn, what I would say is you've got to repair before you build. Given how daunting this inbox is, repair it, stabilize things domestically, and then kind of invest in the foundations internationally, particularly alliances and partners. And then once you've done that, then that gives you a foundation for all you're going to want to do, say, over the next few years, the more creative part of foreign policy. So I find it useful to think of this almost sequentially.
It can be very hard to do what you propose, Richard. It requires a fair amount of discipline, and you have to stick to that discipline, knowing that you have plenty of supporters who want to know why you didn't get these problems solved yesterday, and plenty of critics who want to preemptively tell the world how you've just fallen flat in your face.
Yeah, I always dislike these measures of the first 100 days and other such things, arbitrary. And if you look at the history, you've probably done more of it than I have. It's just as easy to make serious mistakes by trying to do too much too soon. And again, it's both a disadvantage and advantage of the 46th president, maybe COVID. It's such a demanding, it's almost like the sun and it blocks out all the other stars. This may be so demanding and so defining to his situation that in an odd sort of way, it may give him a bit of a rationale for not taking on everything at once. But we have got to get our society back working again. Otherwise, economically, we'll never get to where we have to get. You'll never have a society that will support foreign involvement. Look, I'm not saying there aren't some things that can't wait. You've got an expiring nuclear agreement with Russia. You're going to have to turn to that. You may have to deal with something about an Iran or something about, say, the Taliban with the Afghan agreement. You may want to head off certain things. You may want to do some signals to a North Korea or China. Don't mess around with this. Don't take this step while we're figuring out our policy. I'm not naive. You can't control everything. But the point you made is the word you use is the right one. It's discipline. Presidents can give themselves some space if they articulate. They basically say, look, here's our situation. It's going to be all hands on deck, mainly focusing, say, with COVID. And I just want you to know, and on some, you know, we're going to get to these other things. We got 4 years. Hopefully we've got 8 years. But right now, we have got to get this right, or we're never going to have the option of turning to these other issues. So I actually think that's as the virtue of being true, that argument. And I think it is the virtue of maybe being persuasive. So I hope the administration does something like that and then essentially sticks to it.
Richard, I take your point that COVID may be the big issue that's so large it almost blocks out the sun. And I will note that, as you listed, there was a long litany of other challenges a President Biden would have to deal with. And many of them are issues I would put in the you don't solve them box. They're in the you've got to find a way to manage them box. And that can be, I think, for many people, rather depressing news looking out at the world, because people want to think that problems can be cured and fixed and we can move on to other things. So I'm wondering, from a different perspective, when you look at the Biden agenda, when you look at things in the foreign policy inbox, are there opportunities out there for Biden? Are there things where you think he could actually make a significant difference? And we look back and say, smart, well done.
First of all, let me just pick up on one thing you said. I tend not to use the word problems because people hear the word problem and they think of solution, particularly Americans.
Okay.
And most of the things we're talking about are conditions or situations. The rise of China, the alienation of Putin's Russia, North Korea's nuclear and missile efforts, Iran's imperial ambitions in the Middle East. These go way beyond problems. To think of them as a problem, to think that somehow we can quote unquote solve them, seems to me to misunderstand. These are situations of such difficulty and complexity and dimension that I much prefer to think of them as challenges or, you know, some other word, but any word but problem, because I really want to push people away from thinking there's solutions. It's not like they're a disease about to be cured. It's more like this is a patient. A lot of these are chronic conditions. And what we want to do is make them less bad, keep the patient alive and so forth. Are there opportunities? Sure. There are opportunities if we check certain prerequisites. And I think the most important one besides COVID is alliances. You know, we wake up every morning as a country, and we have dozens of countries who have a history and an openness to working with us on anything and everything under the sun. And that's so if we can revive our alliances, I think it opens up a lot of possibilities. I think there's a real chance to come up with better global health machinery. I think there's some awareness that that needs to be done. And God knows this is not going to be the last pandemic. I think there's a chance to do, if you will, something better on climate change. I think the kind of growing awareness in our country because of these awful fires and storms and around the world. It may not be, by the way, a Paris-like agreement. We might have to use trade agreements to introduce an element of climate, that if you want to sell goods to a certain trading group, you have to meet certain climate criteria, or you might be forced to pay some type of a tariff. But there might be something with green technology sharing. But I think there's areas of climate we can certainly do better than we are doing. I'd like to see us talking with other democracies much more about how we regulate the digital domain and how we stop this interference in one another's political processes. There may be chance for further normalization of relations with Israel, even Saudi Arabia. I wouldn't rule out there. I think there are chances for new trade arrangements, particularly possibly the old Trans-Pacific Partnership, some modernized, expanded version of that. The U.S. could do something in Africa to compete with Belt and Road. I think there's lots of possibilities there. I think we could continue to grow U.S.-India relations. U.S.-India relations are a rare example of a bipartisan consensus and continuity between administrations.
It may even be helped by the fact that the incoming vice president is of Indian descent, and it's an issue of great pride.
Funny you should mention it. Indeed, it was even mentioned in the congratulations message by the government. So, sure, I think there are some opportunities. Nailing down an extension of the U.S.-Russia the START agreement, I think, is a good example of an opportunity. So, I don't mean to communicate the sense of to argue for doing this sequentially and repair before you build. That to me is simply saying there are necessities to repair. And then I think there are some opportunities to build, both thinking about things regionally, to potentially maybe slightly improve U.S.-Chinese relations, but it'll take two to tango there. I think probably the greatest area, Jim, for progress might be on dealing with some of the global issues, to basically get some new arrangements and to close the gap between some of these global challenges and what have thus far been the responses.
Well, Richard, I certainly take your point about the importance of repair, and particularly the importance of repairing relations with friends, partners, and allies. And I will note that that's really the, sort of the great structural advantage the United States has in global politics. It has friends, partners, and allies, and Chinese and the Russians tend more to have clients. But the interesting thing, you talk about allies, you're talking about working with others overseas. I want to take us back home for a moment and talk about working with others across Pennsylvania Avenue or down Pennsylvania. Yeah, you mentioned the magic word bipartisanship a few moments ago. To what extent do you think that Biden might be able to build bipartisanship? He is a man of the Senate, having served there for more than three decades. There are some issues where there's some bipartisan agreement, at least on the problem, not necessarily on the condition. Not necessarily in the response to the condition. So, see, I'm correcting myself, Richard.
Yes,
so,
I mean, that's good. I'll give you an A there. I think there's a couple of things. One is, I don't know this personally, but I'm told he has a good working relationship with Senator McConnell. And depending upon what happens in Georgia, but in some ways, regardless of what happens in Georgia, I think that becomes important. I don't think it's healthy for the United States to conduct foreign policy on a one-party basis. So I think it's important to get Republican buy-in, whether Republicans control 49, 50, or 51 seats in the Senate. I would think, Jim, it's not naive to think that there couldn't be considerable consensus about China. There's a real wariness about China that crosses the aisle. Might be different emphases. Some might worry more about the strategic threat, some the economic threat, some the human rights, political. But there's been a directional change in American thinking about China over the last few years. And so I think there are some possibilities to build on there. And same with Russia. Indeed, even though the Trump White House was reluctant at times to take on Russia under Putin, the Republican Congress was not nearly as reluctant. I think it gets more difficult with something like Iran. I think there the situation is more fraught. And obviously with certain global issues like climate change, there's not yet consensus over refugee issues. There's not a consensus. So I think you're going to have to pick and choose. But if I had to begin by picking and choosing, I would think that great power rivalry might be the area where, at least to begin with, there's the greatest degree of commonality in perceptions of Russia and China.
Just one thing I would add to the list of bipartisan issues out there would be alliances. I think it's quite clear, look on Capitol Hill, that there is strong support for NATO, for U.S. alliances with South Korea and with Japan. And it's not only wide, I think it's actually fairly deep and stable.
I think you're right. I mean, I've spent a lot of time going to things like the Munich Security Conference, and you have people from Republicans and Democrats fly over together and go out drinking at night together. And I actually think those sorts of things matter. The Trump administration was the outlier in a lot of this pulling U.S. troops out of a lot of places. It wasn't really something coming out of Congress. The one thing I'd say, though, about Congress is, again, this is an area of your specialty. I would like going forward, where possible, more things done in the realm of foreign policy had to be approved by Congress. I think it would send a message of a much greater continuity and predictability. One of the lessons a lot of countries have taken around the world is what a president can do, the next president can undo. And that's for a great power where I really do think we need to be seen as reliable and predictable. I think that's really, really works against our influence. So one of the reasons, I'm not naive, if I were advising the administration, I'd take a good run at trying to build some bipartisan cooperation, is just to once again on some important agreements, if it could have some formal backing. I think that would go a long ways towards calming the world a little bit that the United States is too erratic.
Well, I take your point that predictability, or maybe a better way to phrase it, reliability, is an important asset in global politics. Richard, I want to close by putting a spotlight on an implicit assumption in our entire discussion, which is that foreign policy is important and the United States advances its interests by being engaged overseas.
Yes.
You and I have devoted our adult lives to this. This is sort of second nature to us. But I think it's fair to say that there are a fair number of Americans who question that and don't see the United States engagement in the world serving U.S. interests, maybe more accurately, not serving their interests. So what is the message you would give people to help them understand why you think it is important not to neglect foreign policy, even as we have tremendous domestic policy issues that we have to deal with?
I don't fight your basic starting in point. And the fact that the issue barely came up in the debates, barely came up in the town halls, and the exit polls suggested that probably you and I represent a high percentage of those Americans who are thinking about foreign policy when they voted. I take that as a given. But at the same time, think about it. Here we are. The biggest domestic problem is what? A disease that started in Wuhan, China. If you're living on the West Coast or in some other parts of the country, you've got fires or floods or storms. What? Derived or certainly exacerbated dramatically by climate change. We just marked, the 19th anniversary of 9/11, where 3,000 people were killed in this country, nearly 3,000 in a single day by terrorists who were trained in Afghanistan. We have millions of American jobs that are dependent upon access to foreign markets. We just carried out an election where, among other things, we had to cope with foreign interference on social media, where we face a North Korea that has missiles that looks like they can reach the United States and can put nuclear weapons on them. So I've got a long list of ways where, if I had to say it, basically the world matters. And what happens out there, to use my old cliche, it's not Las Vegas. It doesn't stay there. It comes here. So we as citizens have a stake, not just in the world, but in what our government does in the world. Or to put it another way, Jim, globalization is a reality. How we respond to it is a choice. It seems to me it's in our collective interest. If Mr. Jefferson were joining us on this podcast, he would have said that, you know, an informed citizen.
I should have mean Thomas Jefferson and not Jefferson Davis.
Jefferson Davis. Yes, Thomas Jefferson. But so you want an informed citizenry. We want to think about these issues when we vote for people, and after we elect them or they appoint people, we want to hold them to account, because we are going to be affected by the world and the world's going to be affected by what it is they do and how they do it. So look, it's a big part of why I do what I do and you do what you do. It's the reason you mentioned the book I wrote recently. I wrote a primer about the world because I feel that too many people are coming of age and don't understand some of the basic truths or realities about the world. And I think there's a bias in that, Jim. I don't think we need a society of 325 million secretaries of state. Usually one at a time is more than enough. But I worry that if we have a society that doesn't care about the world, it really biases the United States towards isolationism. If people don't care that what goes on in the world, don't think what the United States does in the world matters, then support for foreign policy goes down and down and down. And that seems to me we then walk away from it. And I think we saw some of that in the current administration. And I think that's dangerous. To me, the lesson I derive from history is there's opportunities in the world, but there's also threats out there. And the world doesn't self-organize. It doesn't sort itself out by itself. And what the last 75 years show is that if it is going to get sorted out in a healthy way, we've got to play a significant role, not unilaterally, but with others. And if we do it, the benefits of having done it will far, far, far outweigh any costs. And that, to me, is the basic argument for the United States being active in the world. That one, the world matters. And two, if we do it right, if we do it smart, if we don't overreach, the benefits will be far greater than the cost. And I think what's happened in the last couple of years is we've gone from an era of overreach, perhaps, to an era of underreach. And so I'm concerned about that. So we've got to right size it. And it's not going to be easy because, again, it's going to all have to take place in this context of these really large domestic needs. But I would simply say the world's not going to give us a timeout. The world doesn't basically say, okay, you Americans, go take a couple of years, sort yourselves out. And when you're ready, we'll be glad to have you back. It doesn't work that way. History doesn't have a pause button. So I think what we've got to do is figure out how do we sort ourselves out at home with COVID and other issues. At the same time, do enough to basically repair the world, put down some kind of new scaffolding, and then just maybe we can get more ambitious down the road.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the author of the book, The World, A Brief Introduction. Richard, thanks for an excellent discussion.
Great to be with you, my friend.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.